Order.
The week turned into a race against the clock for the government, keen to get its controversial health and safety reform bill passed before the House adjourned on Thursday evening. With another week's adjournment looming and the loss of a day's chamber time to questions, general debate and members' bills on Wednesday, government backbenchers were keen to put a cork in the opposition's filibuster before 10 on Tuesday night. After adding another 6 hours to the 8 they had piled up the previous week in the part-by-part debate on the bill with the House sitting as a committee, the opposition were keen to force the debate past the adjournment at 10 on Tuesday, thereby leaving the government the Hobson's choice of putting the House under urgency to complete the committee stage and the third reading debate together on Thursday.
Mr Chairman.
I move the question be now put.
Yes, order.
Accepting the call for a vote from National's Jonathan Young, with about 10 minutes to go, Assistant Speaker Lindsay Tish had heard enough.
We've canvassed quite widely the issues. It's become quite repetitive on clauses 1 and 2.
They contain the bill's title and date of commencement, and are usually debated last, are fairly wide-ranging, and inevitably echo the main themes of the debate, as represented in this question for the Prime Minister John Key on Tuesday from Opposition Leader Andrew Little.
Given that ACC charges twice the levy on dairy farming that it does on lavender growing, why does he say that lavender growing is high risk, but dairy farming isn't?
Right, Honourable Speaker, Prime Minister.
If the test was one against the other, I'd probably tend to agree with the member, but the test isn't that. Lavender farming will be included in the other category. Government's going through a consultation of those, and they may well be taken out.
What a
hopeless government.
In questions to ministers and in the debate itself, the opposition exploited the anomalies created by classifying risk in various sectors and the exclusion of conventional farming from the need to have health and safety representatives in the workforce. They were in the raft of amendments that the government tabled at the start of the debate last week. Had the opposition looked more closely towards the back of that supplementary order paper, they might have found new material that would have carried their debate through into Thursday. Material that didn't surface until the final minutes of the third reading debate, when Labor's Shadow Attorney General, David Parker, questioned amendments protecting the secrecy of classified security information in court cases involving the new health and safety law.
Very late in the process, the government, at Select Committee, after submissions had been called and had closed, introduced some changes in respect of the way in which trials would be conducted where there was classified security information involved. Mr Speaker, the Law Society wasn't told about it, the Council of Civil Liberties wasn't told about it, and they were surprised when they found out about it.
David Parker said the Law Society had written to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, Michael Woodhouse, last Friday, August the 21st.
They noted that this was, in their opinion, a breach of the New Zealand Bill of Rights. And I want to remind the House that the Bill of Rights at Section 25 says the minimum standards of criminal procedure include a right to a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial court, the right to be present at trial, and that's abrogated in some circumstances by these provisions, and to present a defence, which is undermined by these provisions, and the right to examine the witnesses for the prosecution, all of which are absolutely basic rights.
And are set out in the Bill of Rights Act, which this week, coincidentally, celebrated the 25th anniversary of its enactment on August the 28th, 1990, and was also the subject of a briefing in one of the committee rooms on Wednesday morning, as Rhys Lyon reports.
The Law and Order Committee was briefed by officials from the Attorney General's Office on the relationship between the Bill of Rights Act and legislation implementing electronic monitoring of offenders. Attorney General's Office Senior Policy Advisor Michael Gill explained the role of the Attorney General's reports under Section 7 of the Act.
Section 7 requires the Attorney General to bring to the attention of the House any provision of a bill that appears to be inconsistent with the rights and freedoms affirmed in the Bill of Rights. This process is designed to ensure that decisions made by Parliament to limit fundamental rights and freedoms are not taken without its full knowledge and prior consideration. Parliament may, of course, decide to legislate in a manner inconsistent with the Bill of Rights, if it considers that the circumstances warrant it.
Attorney General's Office Policy Advisor Elise Daly Sadgrove outlined the findings of the Attorney General's report in relation to the electronic monitoring of offenders legislation bill.
It found electronic monitoring limits three rights, so that's the freedom of movement, and also the rights against unreasonable search and seizure and double jeopardy.
A point Ms. Daly Sadgrove explained further.
So that's the right against double jeopardy, which basically prohibits offenders being punished twice for the same offending, or more than once for the same offending. So the breach in the extended supervision order regime occurs because extended supervision orders punish the offender over and above the initial sentence that was handed down and after that sentence has been determined.
Michael Gill outlined the two stages taken into account when considering possible breaches of the Bill of Rights Act.
Whether a right or freedom is limited, and if so, is it justifiable? So concepts which are generally used to justify limitations of rights are things along the lines of protecting public safety. In other contexts, things like the need to maintain security of borders, all sorts of various things that you would go through. The fact that a Section 7 report was issued indicates that in this context, the part of the electronic monitoring regime which interacts with the extended supervision order regime was considered not justifiable.
Attorney General's Office Senior Policy Advisor Michael Gill with that briefing to the Law and Order Committee.
Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber, David Parker wound up his criticism of the Attorney General, Christopher Finlayson, who's also the minister in charge of the two spy agencies, the SIS and the GCSB.
For the attorney then to criticise the Law Society that they were somehow misinformed and they were getting it wrong is in my opinion, beyond the pale, and I don't think the attorney should have said those things, sir. This is an inappropriate breach of the Bill of Rights, of the ability of people to have a fair trial, and I don't think we in this Parliament have properly protected that fundamental interest. Mr. Speaker, it's wrong. It applies to the police, not just the SIS, not just the GSB. This is far too broad. It's wrong in principle. I can't see how it can ever be justified in respect of a health and safety reform bill.
Labor's Shadow Attorney General David Parker, who was followed by the final government speaker in the third reading debate.
Dr. Parmjit Parmar.
Mr. Speaker, this is a great bill and I support this bill and commend the bill to the House.
And with that brief contribution, the government's health and safety reform legislation, split into five separate bills, passed its third and final reading with just a few minutes left before Thursday's adjournment at 6. The Māori Party Act and United Future adding their four votes to National's 59 to give the government a majority of 63 to defeat the 58 of all other parties combined. Although Parmjit Parmar's five-second speech was by far the shortest, she was not the only government speaker who didn't take their full 10 minutes available to them after the government lost another hour and a half following this announcement at the end of Thursday's questions from the Speaker, David Carter.
I have received a letter from Carmel Cipollone seeking to debate Understanding Order 389, the State of Care 2015 report on child, youth and family from the Office of the Children's Commissioner. The report deals with child, youth and family, which is the service arm of the Ministry of Social Development. The report raises many very serious concerns about the care of vulnerable children by the state. It recommends significant changes to improve outcomes for children. Having carefully considered this application and read the report, I believe it does require the urgent attention of the House.
The debate was then led off by Carmel Cipollone's caucus colleague, Labor's spokeswoman on children, Jacinda Ardern.
Mr. Speaker, the report that we have before us today is an absolute indictment, and it is only right that this House gives its time and consideration to what can only be considered some of the most important issues that we have a responsibility to address as members of this Parliament.
And among questions for the Minister of Social Development on Thursday was this one from Carmel Cipollone.
Does she agree with the statement by the Children's Commissioner that we don't know if children are better off as a result of state intervention, but the indications are not good?
The Honourable Anne Tolley.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I have been concerned at the lack of data that tracks children through and beyond state care. And that is why in April I appointed an expert panel to lead a complete overhaul of New Zealand's child protection system to ensure that we get better results for children in care and to ensure that money is invested in the areas that will make the biggest difference for those children.
The Minister for Social Development, Anne Tolley. As well as the government's loss of chamber time to that urgent debate on Thursday, Wednesday's question time was followed by the general debate, in which the United Future member for Ohario, Peter Dunn, used his 5 minutes to launch a fierce attack on the New Zealand Transport Agency, the NZTA.
We do have an agency here that, in my view, is now out of control.
Mr Dunn urged Transport Minister Simon Bridges to take the opportunity to restructure the NZTA.
Mr Speaker, it may be coincidental, but I note that the chief executive of the organisation has resigned effective from the end of the year. I want to say to the minister that I think this creates an opportunity to restructure the NZTA, to make sure it becomes far less of an arrogant, we know best organisation that works closely with the local authorities and the people that it represents and serves, and implements solutions that meet the community's needs, not the aspirations of the engineers within the NZTA. And I think, sir, that the opportunity will be there with a new chief executive for a change of direction. And in the interests of a number of communities around New Zealand, I urge the minister to take that course.
United Future's Peter Dunn in Wednesday's general debate, which was followed by the second and third readings of a members' bill from the leader of the other one-man party, the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour. His bill enabling bars and clubs to open all hours during the Rugby World Cup matches had been reported back from the Justice and Electoral Committee after being tabled in the chamber 2 weeks ago, bypassing the members' ballot. The committee spent some 8 hours behind closed doors discussing the bill and the approximately 120 submissions, all but a handful of which opposed the bill. Given leave again for its second and third readings to be taken together, 4 hours of debate on Wednesday ended with National, New Zealand First, ACT, United Future and 26 Labour MPs in favour of it, while the Green Party, Maori Party and 6 Labour MPs voted against it. Now back to the committee rooms with Rhys Lyon.
On Thursday, the Justice and Electoral Committee's inquiry into the 2014 election saw Electoral Commission Chairman Sir Hugh Williams lament the declining rate of electoral enrolment by young New Zealanders. Labelling the downward trend in enrolment and voting as a major concern, Sir Hugh warned of the long-term effects of declining youth enrolment rates.
In time, as those persons become parents themselves, the likelihood is that they won't inculcate enrolment and voting habits in their children, because it's clearly established by the international research that if parents don't vote, it raises the likelihood that their children won't vote.
Sir Hugh was also concerned about the reasons people gave for not voting.
A lot of the reasons given for people not voting are just plainly illogical, but crucially, 27% of the people who didn't vote said they didn't vote because they had lacked any interest in voting. We think that's deplorable. 11% didn't vote because they said they didn't know how to vote or who to vote for. We think that too is most unfortunate. That means 38% of the non-voting public simply were disengaged.
However, Sir Hugh was sceptical about calls for automatic voter registration.
Enrolment should be one of the rites of passage for young New Zealanders as they become adult, just like getting a driver's licence or something like that. But would New Zealanders wear compulsory voting? And I suspect there would be quite a bit of drawback from that position.
The Electoral Commission Chairman appealed to the committee to help address the problem of declining enrolment and electoral participation.
Those are indicators of a serious threat to democracy, and that underpins our suggestion that the committee should recommend that Parliament adopts a nationwide national strategy to try and improve enrolment and voting and participation in the democratic process generally.
Electoral Commission Chairman Sir Hugh Williams giving evidence to the Justice and Electoral Committee's inquiry into the 2014 election. Also this week, the Health Committee called for submissions on a petition in the name of former Labour MP Marion Street, calling on Parliament to investigate public attitudes towards euthanasia. For more on how to make a submission on that and other business before the House, check out our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz, and click on Make Submission at the top of the page.
Rhys Lyon, and he'll be back after this more detailed look at that bill that'll allow bars and clubs to open in the early morning for matches in the Rugby World Cup, which this year is being held on the other side of the world, outside of our normal drinking times. The bill was brought into the House by the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour, who sought to table it in the chamber, bypassing the conventional route for members' bills, which is the ballot, which currently contains around 70 other members' bills. His first request for leave was blocked, but his second attempt succeeded after he assured the Greens that their concerns would be addressed when the bill was with a select committee. And that was the Justice and Electoral Committee, which spent some 8 hours discussing the bill behind closed doors. As well as taking advice from officials, the committee had around 120 submissions from the public to consider. All but about 5 of them were opposed to the bill proceeding any further. Nevertheless, it was reported back to the chamber on Wednesday, ready for its second and third readings to be taken together, again by prior agreement of all parties. And so 4 hours of debate began with this from David Seymour.
I predict that what will happen is that the overwhelming majority of people will come out early in the morning for breakfast and a coffee, maybe a lemonade or a shandy, and maybe a pint of beer. And the question for the opponents of this bill is, why should law-abiding, responsible New Zealanders not be able to do that? Rather than the question the opponents would like us to answer is, how will you justify yourselves to us? Mr. Speaker, this is fundamentally about individual freedom and personal responsibility.
Which nevertheless required legislation from Parliament, according to Nationals member for Wairarapa, Alistair Scott.
This bill allows this House to be the licensing board on behalf of all New Zealand. So there will be consistency across the country when it comes to special licences. So this, sir, is us legislating a special licence for all New Zealanders. The people who are opposed, particularly the Greens, are just they're just not on this planet, sir. They become the wet blanket on this bill that is about celebrating our national sport.
Alistair Scott's words were reinterpreted in the third reading by the Greens' Kevin Haigh, who said the bill was cutting across the principle underpinning the sale of liquor legislation of minimising harm from alcohol.
The Law Commission and this House was clear that one of the ways that needed to be done was by restricting the hours that alcohol was available for sale. So that seems kind of cutting across-y to me. And then what we said in the debate around this bill when it went through the House in 2012 was that we would deal with events that fell outside of normal licensed hours by means of special licences. We specified that the Rugby World Cup and indeed international sporting fixtures more generally were precisely the kinds of things for which special licences were created. And Mr. Speaker, what that does, of course, is it enables licensing committees to assess an application for a special licence according to the circumstances of the applicant, and enables the licensing committee to impose conditions that are able to meet the primary objective of the Principal Act, to minimise harm associated with that extension of licensed hours. So it seems to me that when Alistair Scott in the second reading said what this Parliament is doing is going over the heads of local government and imposing a blanket special licence to almost everyone, actually that is precisely what cutting across the intent of the original Act is all about.
Kevin Haigh said David Seymour and National had failed to honour agreements made before the bill went to a select committee.
Mr. Speaker, we agreed, the Green Party agreed, to allow this bill to go forward to a select committee so that the public's views could be heard on the basis, first of all, that claims were being made that the special licensing regime was not working as intended. Those have proved exaggerated at best. And also on the basis of undertakings made by the ACT and national parties. I'm sad to say that those undertakings have not been honoured.
There was qualified support for Kevin Hague and the Greens from the New Zealand First Party's Clayton Mitchell.
And we do actually support the Greens in part of what they've been saying, insofar as we would like to see a review put together to actually get a clearer outline on what constitutes a special licence. Because this is what this is about. This has been some councils, some areas, some police around the country, and I can say openly that Christchurch, from my anecdotal evidence, has been very, very supportive by the police, by the council and by the health department to make sure that the majority of those special licences have actually been granted. And then other parts of the country where the interpretation of what constitutes a special licence has been interpreted another way, where some what I would consider to be ridiculous insertions into their conditions of opening up for the Rugby World Cup.
No sympathy for the Greens, though, from National's Nick Smith.
And the thing I just cannot understand from the Green Party, why is it when it comes to alcohol, they want to take an extreme adverse risk approach and to say we're not prepared to accept any risk at all, and then it comes to cannabis and they want to legalise it and liberalise it at the opposite end of the spectrum? They're just... I'm sorry? No, I'm just simply saying to the member, for them on the one hand to say that they oppose this bill because the risk of the odd person misusing alcohol, where on the other hand the evidence is so compelling about the level of harm that's done from cannabis, and over again we hear from Green Party members an argument to liberalise cannabis law, and I say what a grossly inconsistent approach that the Green Party brings to this bill, and that's why I have great difficulty with the position of such extreme cautiousness around this sale and supply of alcohol during the Rugby World Cup bill. Mr Speaker, I'm pleased the Select Committee has made the choice to enable all of the Rugby World Cup games to be enjoyed in this fashion. It is absolutely sensible, I say to Mr Seymour, for you to allow the bar or the licensed premise to make the choice as to what games they want to host. I don't know whether there's large, maybe South African populations in the North Shore that the bars may choose to open there. In my area, I happen to have a large number of UK, and they may choose to use those games. Why should it be that Parliament has to overrule what choice there might be, let the individual proprietor make an assessment in their community about the level of interest, and on the basis of that, then decide as to whether they are going to host those games?
The debate on the third reading of the bill ended with the Māori Party changing sides, having cast two votes in favour of the bill at the end of its second reading. In the end, David Seymour's bill attracted support from himself, the National Party, New Zealand First and 26 Labour MPs, while the Greens were joined in opposition by the Māori Party and 6 Labour MPs. Now the final word from Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard, cutting short this invitation from David Seymour.
Does the member have a point of order?
Yes, there will be a brief celebration of the passage of the bill in Mountain House 1107.
Right.
Thank you.
The member is now being disorderly.
Now back to Rhys Lyon with a report on a difficulty with a question for the Prime Minister.
Opposition questions intended for the Prime Minister being transferred by the government to other senior ministers for answering was the subject of a point of order raised by Labour's Shadow Leader of the House, Grant Robertson, on Thursday.
Here's two parts to the point of order I'm raising. This question was set down to the Prime Minister and asked him to whether he stood by a statement. That statement was made in this House. There's no dispute that the statement was made. It was in Hansard.
Order, can I just have the point of order?
The point of order, Mr Speaker, is that I believe the transfer of the question undermines the integrity of question time. I do not understand how the opposition can hold the Prime Minister to account when direct quotes that he has given in this House are transferred. If you will indulge me, Mr Speaker, the second part of my point of order is that the option that then gives the opposition is to simply ask the Prime Minister, does he stand by all his statements? That is a ridiculous situation because that question wouldn't be transferred. We then lose valuable supplementary questions and the opportunity is opened up for the Minister answering to say they don't have the material available to them. I think this kind of transfer undermines the integrity of question time.
However, the Speaker, David Carter, did not sympathise with Mr Robertson's view.
I don't agree with the member. If order. If I felt for 1 minute that it did, in transferring, undermine the integrity of question time and effectively it was an anathema to the justice of the question time system, then I would not allow the transfer. I think there are, in regards to the second point made by Grant Robertson, there are ways that this question could have been worded in such a way that it couldn't have been transferred, and that includes ways that are more general than just does the Prime Minister stand by a statement. I suggest that if he wants advice on the wording of that, he takes some advice from perhaps the clerk, the office of the clerk, to help him in further wording questions so that it is more difficult for the transfer to occur. But in this case, the transfer is the right of the government, provided it doesn't in any way mean the shifting of responsibility doesn't get a fair chance to answer. The question, in essence, is around KiwiSaver. That responsibility is in the hands of the Minister of Finance, and I think the question can proceed if the member wishes to continue.
Mr. Robertson then sought some clarification from the Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, the ability for a minister...
Order, can I just have the first point of order?
The point of order is this. How is it not anathema to...
Order. Now the member is questioning a ruling I've just given. I've been quite clear about it. If the member wants to raise a fresh point of order, I'll hear it. But if it... Order. The member might want to resume. We get to a very disorderly state in this House if members then continue to relitigate, particularly when they lead me to believe it's a fresh point of order, and as they get into their so-called fresh point of order, it's simply a case to argue the case with me. That is unacceptable. I've made a ruling. The member can shake his head and say that he doesn't agree with it. I think there's frequent opportunities for members to disagree with rulings that they make, that I make in this House, but at the end of the day, they must accept them.
Mr. Robertson then tried another tack.
A fresh point of order, yes. Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave of the House for this question to be transferred back to the Prime Minister.
Order. I invite the member to look at Speaker's ruling 1695. I'm not putting that leave.
With that, Mr. Robertson's question was duly put to the Finance Minister instead.
Does he stand by the Prime Minister's statement that, quote, the removal of the $1,000 Kickstart contribution will not make a blind bit of difference to the number of people who join KiwiSaver?
And that question was fielded on the Finance Minister's behalf by his Cabinet colleague, Stephen Joyce.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, yes. This was based on advice from officials, which stated, and I quote, this change is likely to have only limited effect, if any, on enrolment rates in KiwiSaver amongst the legislated target population because other subsidies and employer contributions remain in place. Incentives for people to join KiwiSaver include auto enrolment when starting a new job, the 3% employer contribution, and the member tax credit of up to $521 each year, all of which significantly outweighs the $1,000 kickstart payment when taken together.
Mr. Robertson also had questions about the Prime Minister's official advice.
Why did the Prime Minister tell this House, quote, that the formal advice from IRD, end quote, was that sign-up rates for KiwiSaver would not be affected by cutting the kickstart, when the IRD regulatory impact statement on cutting this kickstart includes paragraph 44 entitled Lower Numbers of KiwiSavers, particularly among the self-employed and children?
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, the paper and the regulatory impact statement makes a number of comments. I draw the member's attention to paragraph 56 of the Cabinet paper, which says this change is likely to have only limited effect, if any, on enrolment rates in KiwiSaver among the legislative target population because other subsidies and employer contributions remain in place. In terms of the regulatory impact statement, which is available online to members, paragraph 32 says a number of things and says, therefore, removal of the kickstart would reduce fiscal costs without reducing savings rates.
Associate Finance Minister Stephen Joyce.
This report from East Lyon. I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.